just having downstairs, I'd like to bring you all back in on, because it is just so central to where we are today. Pastor Ron was showing us a brochure on a seminar coming up about sexual purity for men. I cannot tell you how important that is in our day. It is the leading sin. It is the leading battle of our generation, sexual purity. I was relating with them downstairs, a young man. We went through something similar to this about 4 years ago in our church. And I didn't realize what a problem there was. And as I talked with the men very frankly, very openly, about my own struggles with pornography when I was younger, thank you, what that looked like and how gracious the Lord was in leading me out of that. And I tell you, there's nothing, if you've been bound by anything like that, there's nothing like 2 years out waking up one morning and say, my Lord, you've been so gracious. 2 years, 4 years, 10 years, 15 years. When it seemed to dominate your life, and it's the kind of thing we bury, we hide. And of course, sin needs to be brought into the light if it's going to be dealt with, if it's going to be dealt with. We spoke on this at our church, and one gentleman came to me shortly after. And he said, let me tell you, he said, when I was 13, my dad's birthday present to me at becoming a man was to take me to a brothel. And he said, that gripped my life from that moment on. And he said, I have been with a prostitute at least once a week since, if I could afford it. And the pornography. And he said, I thought when I got saved, that would end. And he said, the struggle got buried, but it intensified. Once I wasn't fighting it, now I am fighting it, and now it's bondage. And he said, I thought, well, when I get married, that'll fix it. He married a lovely Christian gal, godly woman. And he said, and to my devastation, that did not end. And he said, here I am now. I've been married 3 years. And what do I do? And we said, well, we need to bring your wife in on this. And we sat down together, and he confessed his sin, and it destroyed her. But she said, I love you. And I married you for better or for worse. And with God's help, we're gonna go through this. And I just heard from them a couple weeks ago. It's been 4 years and he has been pure. But let me tell you what that took. He, that night, when we met with his wife, our elders, and we met with them to pray and talk, that night he handed her his ATM card. He said, I can't have cash in my pocket. And I can't have access to it because the temptation's too great. And then he went home and his business was in computers. And he said, number one, my wife has complete access to every keystroke I make. And he signed a bunch of us elders up on covenant eyes so that we could keep accountable with him over everything he watched on the internet. And then he said, that's not enough. He said, I can't be alone. Because when I'm alone, I'm tempted and I will do things. I need friends who I can call and say, don't let me be alone. I need to be with other Christian people, praying, studying, staying busy. And then he said, I've got to switch careers. I cannot be on the internet all day for my job and stay pure. And he quit his job and went back to school and got a nursing degree so that he could be out of that environment. As I think Pastor Schinkel put it just right. He had to pluck his eye out. He had to cut his right hand off. And his wife stuck with him, prayed with him, walked with him through that whole time. But he is serious about what we've been talking about these last two sessions. And God will give you grace. God will work. Don't hesitate to attack any sin in your life. Don't. There is nothing worth losing heaven over. Nothing. If you'd turn with me to Proverbs 25, this was originally what I wanted to get at. There are some things in life that you hear them and you learn them, I know I've thrown a ton of material at you already these last 2 days. I'm going to throw a ton more at you right now. And it would be absolutely foolish of me to say, you know, you should just get all these things in your head and memorize them, keep them, and move on. What I'm hoping for is that one or two things will stick out inordinately that you'll be able to latch on to that would be really useful over time. When I was young, my dad would always do all of his own car work. And every time the car wouldn't start right, he would look at me and he would say, "A car needs spark and it needs fuel. If it won't start, it's one of those two things." Now, that just stuck with me, but that's true. It's one of those things you just stick down and you say, that is absolutely true. It's always going to be true. You've got to figure that out. Jim Croce said, you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull the mask off the old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim. That's true. Those are things you can stick in your head and remember. You can keep those. Proverbs is written with that kind of thought process in mind. One commentator mentions Proverbs this way. He says that it is, quote, the best of all manuals for the formation of a well-balanced mind. The object of Solomon in composing it seems to have been to furnish the church a summary of rules and maxims by which the Christian character, having been originated in regeneration, should be educated and made symmetrical. It's a wonderful way of understanding how the book of Proverbs works. In fact, it's an extraordinarily complex book because it's Jewish poetry. The Hebrew poetry functions so differently than ours. I love poetry. Miss Houston, my fourth grade teacher, made me write my first poem. And I've been in love with poetry ever since. I remembered that poem. It's an epic poem. I'll share it with you right now. Once there was a hairy ape who lived inside the Congo. From his cage he did escape and learned to play the bongo. It's very good. And it rhymed. It was in meter. It was proportioned properly. Since then, I've been in love with poetry. Fortunately, better poetry than my own. And so the complexity of some of the sections in Proverbs is really amazing. But for our purposes, we're not going to delve into distichs and tristichs and all those other things that are here for us. But I do want to turn your attention to this particular passage and throw a lot of these things at you in rapid fire with hopes that one or two will stick and will be helpful for you over time as you continue to pursue this walk that we have in our common, the common goal that Christ has for us, which is to be conformed to His image. That's what we're ever after. Now, we get a little bit of an introduction here, and that's why I called this initially the proverbial leader. It's playing off this concept of Proverbs. This is lessons in wise leadership. And verse 1 says, "These also are Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied." There's an obscure passage in the Old Testament that we don't hit often that reminds us that when a king became king in Israel, one of his first duties, one of the things that was required of him, was that he was to sit down and write a copy of the Torah, the first five books, the Pentateuch, in his own handwriting. That's so he could never plead ignorance. Right? I am familiar with what God has said. I understand it. And I've got it here in my own writing as a testimony against me. It was a wonderful tool. Those who ruled and ruled wisely are always looking for the things that make for being able to rule wisely. And as we're talking about being leaders having others follow us as we're pursuing this image of Christ in our lives, here Hezekiah is sitting down and saying, we need to collect these things and so that we can remind ourselves of them, go through them, use them, find them. And so I'm going to give you these again, rather rapid fire. I'm not going to deal with the connections within the actual structure of Proverbs as much as each of these keys to being a wise and good administrator. That's what this was for. This was a king collecting wisdom to understand how to rule well, how to lead well. That's why it's particularly applicable to us. Now, the first thing he gives us here, and some of these I'll expand on, and the rest of them I'm going to run through very rapid fire, and you won't know which. Well, yeah, you will. You'll figure that out, won't you? The first thing that he mentions here in verse 2 is that it is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings is to search things out. And if you're going to be filling in the blanks, let me just... Their first one is then, good leaders labor to avoid obscurity and promote discovery and revelation. Any idiot can make things complicated. Making it clear is difficult. And good leaders want people to know the truth. They don't want to hide the truth. It is a trait of cults and the Gnostics in the early church and others who want power over people to keep the information to themselves. Good leaders, righteous leaders, want everybody to have the information. This is why Jesus spent so much time teaching the disciples and then wanting the disciples to teach others. And then Paul saying, all right, Timothy, find good, faithful men that you can commit these things to so that they can teach them to others. We don't want this little thing of hidden knowledge that there's this special group of people who have spiritual knowledge that nobody else has. We want everyone in the body of Christ to know as much of these glorious truths as we possibly can. And as good leaders, we want to do that in our homes too. And of course, that spills over into the fact that as men, we can't lead our families or our churches if we live secret lives. We can't have secret lives. We've got to bring things out in the open, or if we fail to traffic in the truth. One of the things that Jesus did that I find very difficult, and I'll confess to you that I had to do something in order to come to this retreat. I like solitude. Probably simply because people often annoy me. I don't know. I don't know what that's all about. I'm a misanthrope. But I like solitude to a certain degree. And when I travel, I especially like solitude. I had to do that for business for a number of years. And to a certain degree, I'm sure that it is a sinful inclination to remain hidden. Now, my wife wasn't able to come with me on this trip. And I thought, now, I like traveling with her. She already knows all my ugly stuff, and she still likes me. So I'm very comfortable with her. And so I did something I never do. I called a friend of mine and said, I'm going out to Michigan to be part of this men's retreat. It's a great bunch of guys. I wish you could meet them. Would you please go along with me? I almost bit my tongue to make it bleed while I said that, because the last thing I wanted to do was ride for 6 hours here than 6 hours home with this other guy in the car. I'd rather be alone. But of course, that's not healthy. It's not healthy. So Jesus did the worst thing I can imagine. For 3.5 years, he traveled with these men. He ate with them. He slept with them. He talked with them. They watched him go through every conceivable human circumstance. What a glorious way to teach. But you see, what he did was he didn't traffic in obscurity, but in truth and openness. And as men before God, we need to walk that way. He had nothing to hide. And often we do fear how we'll lose credibility or mar the image that we want to project to others. But no, we traffic in the truth. And more, if we're going to lead others, we need to be careful to communicate clearly and accurately within context to them. My oldest brother's best friend is Ronnie Kozel. Ronnie was about 12 when his dad was replacing the brakes on the car. And Ronnie said to his dad, "Dad, why do we have to put new brakes on the car?" And his dad said, "Well, because they squeak, son." And then his dad got a phone call and went in the house. When his dad came back out, he looked at the brakes that he had just put on the car. The wheels were not yet back on. And he said, "Ronnie, the brakes look a little funny." And he said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, they're dark and they're dripping." He said, "What did you do, son?" He said, "I oiled the brakes, Dad, because you said they squeak. And when things squeak, you oil them." Well, now, Ron's dad had communicated clearly, but not clearly enough given his audience. And as men, especially in our homes, we can do that, can't we? Have you ever told a 4-year-old, clean up your room? They have no concept what that means. You've got to give them the A, B's, and C's, the nuts and the bolts. And we even have to do that with one another. to labor, to be clear, to be open, to be honest, and especially in communicating biblical truth when we can. Ours isn't to obscure or to hide. Being angry at a child when you've told them to clean their room and you haven't told them what that means in unmistakable terms is just going to lead to disaster. And we need to do that for one another. You've all had that. Your wife has said, "Hey, I want you to paint the house." Well, you know, there's a lot involved in that. What color? How would you like the brush strokes to really go? There's a lot of things there. Clarity. 2. Verse 3. As the heavens for height and the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable. All leaders find this out, if you're filling in the blanks, that all leaders' motives will most certainly be misunderstood at one time or another. If you want to be a leader, and we are called to that, and you're afraid of having your motives judged or misunderstood, well, you're going to need to buck up a little. Our motives are going to be misunderstood. If they misunderstood Jesus' motives, if some thought that he wanted an earthly kingdom, if some thought that he was looking for earthly power, then we too have to be prepared to face the fact that many are going to attach to us motives that have never even remotely entered our hearts. And you can't spend all your time putting out those fires. You just can't. As leaders, we've got to be occupied with being consumed, with being conformed to the image of Christ. And so whether people understand that or misunderstand that is going to be irrelevant. Such things are powerful for getting us off track from our goal. The enemy's greatest tactics against us are distraction, division, and depression. And anything he can use to distract us, he will, and we buy into it. Others thought that Jesus wanted power, like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. When Nehemiah was engaged in rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem, Sanballat and Tobiah were his enemies, and they had written to him. A total of 5 times they tried to oppose him in writing. They tried to accuse him of doing the work for the purpose of inciting rebellion against the king of Babylon. In Nehemiah 6:8, and I got this really from, I stole this directly from Alistair Begg. He said that often when he preaches, people will write him a note and they'll say, "Oh, well, you know, you've got some hidden idea here, or some hidden agenda, or some. And he says, "I'll try to clear it up once or twice. If I can't do it then I send them a card with this scripture written on it and sign it, Love, Alistair." This is what he quotes, Nehemiah 6:8-9. "Then I sent to him saying, 'No such thing as you say has been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind.'" That's it. He says, "I send him that verse. You're just inventing this out of your own mind. Love, Alistair. I'm done." And because they were just trying to get him off track. Sometimes it's just being clear. And there's a good warning here in that, though, let me say, for you and me, to do the same thing and not impute motives to other people. Half the time we don't know why we do things, let alone why other people do it. And to start assuming that we can peer into the hearts of men with some mystical omniscience and know exactly why they made a particular facial gesture, why or not they shook our hand or hugged us or said hi instead of hello, all that weird stuff that pops up in our brains, we don't know. I don't know why our government did the stimulus package. We're never going to know. I don't have to know. I've got to deal with the fact that I've got the stimulus package. I don't know about you, but I don't feel stimulated. But the truth is, we've got to be careful that we don't judge other people's motives either. It is so easy to impute motives to people. If we don't want them to impute motives to us, let's not impute motives to them, especially as leaders. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. And then this amazing approach. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. The first duty of love is to give the full benefit of any doubt and to put the best possible construction on it until the facts force us in the opposite direction. That's love. I had a job once where I sold restaurant equipment. I got a call from a restaurant I'd never heard of in Rochester. They said, we'd like you to come down and bid on a certain piece of equipment for us.
Gladly. So I drove by it on the way home because I'd never seen the place before. And I drove by it and I realized what it was a strip club with a restaurant attached. And I thought, oh man, what am I going to do with this? Well, I figured I'll go at 9 o'clock in the morning because they're not open then. So I made the appointment. I said, I can't be there any other time but 9 o'clock in the morning. The guy said, fine. I walked in the door at 9 o'clock in the morning and the bar was full. I don't even know where the cars were, but you know, this is illegal, of course. And there are things going on. So I'm running through into the kitchen so that I can do the work I've got to do. And then when I walked out the front door, it dawned on me. Somebody in my church is going to see me walking out the front door of this building. And they're going to call other people and say, you know what I saw him doing? So I picked up the phone. The first thing I did was I called my wife and I said, when you get the phone call that I was coming out of the dollhouse, let me explain now. Oh boy, don't impute motives. I'm sure somebody still has that story around. Oh boy, Reed passed, you know, he was running into that strip club. No, I was running out. Verses 4 and 5. Take away the dross from the silver, and the smith has material for a vessel. Take away the wicked from the presence of the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness. I take two things from this short passage. First, leaders recognize that A, purifying precedes usefulness. Purifying precedes usefulness. Oh, how we have to pay attention to this. God sends trial and tribulation to us for the very purpose of purifying us. Nowhere do our imperfections get surfaced more or better than in the heat of affliction. I didn't know how cantankerous I was till I got in trouble. Then you find out how impatient you are, how irritable you are when you're going through trial. That's when it comes out. But that purifying process, and that's all it does, it helps bring these things to the surface so that we can deal with them. Not so that we can shove them back down, but deal with them. And that always increases usefulness. I have found in my own life, as short as it has been thus far, and imperfect and useful where it has almost always been through the result of a weakness that God has had to deal with in my life. Not my strengths. My strengths don't seem to help very many people. It's where I've been weak and God has had to intervene that seems to have ministered. And our usefulness is tied directly to purity. The second thing that I take from that is that leaders may often suffer the loss of key or elemental people in the heat of trial. You see, the dross at times are elements that are part of our pool, part of where we are. And sometimes that dross has to be taken away from the silver. It's not a moral judgment. It's saying that there are elements here, and sometimes key elements, people around us who are going to have to move on or things are going to have to change. I could liken that to the reality of pruning an even healthy plant so that it can have more fruitfulness, so it can be more bountiful and grow. Verses 6 and 7. Do not put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the place of the great. For it is better to be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of a noble. What your eyes have seen really belongs with the following verse, verse 8. James 3:1, and well, for the use filling in the blanks, true leaders do not seek self-promotion. True leaders do not seek self-promotion. It's interesting, over the years, we have somehow so misread certain verses. One being, if a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good thing. As though that automatically means, well, then he's qualified because he wants it. Lots of people want things they aren't qualified for. You know?
Alvin Plantinga, a number of years ago, Christian philosopher from Calvin College, went off and became the head, the chair of the philosophy department at Notre Dame, of all things. Here's a Reformed Protestant philosopher, now the chair of the philosophy department at a Roman Catholic school. And when they asked him why he did that, he said, because I want to be the first Protestant pope. There's some things you aren't qualified for, and he wasn't going to be it either. We don't seek self-promotion. That's not how we grow in grace. It's not how we grow in usefulness. Remember the words in James 3:1, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. Or Jesus' own words in Luke 14. Now, he told a parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him, and he who invited you will come and say to you, well, give your place to this person, and then you'll begin with shame to take the lowest place. That's an embarrassing moment. I've had that one. I don't know if you have or not. It's unpleasant. It's fun to go into a place and sit at the head table and then realize you weren't part of that group. And to have them say in front of everyone, your table's over there. That, you know, that one near the kitchen? Yeah, that's where you... That's always a pleasant experience. No, leadership isn't seeking self-promotion. I love the account of David's great yearning to build a temple for God. And he prays about this, and he really wants to do this, and then he calls for the prophet to come and speak to him and says, my desire is to build this temple for God in Jerusalem. And the prophet says to him, well, this is a right desire. I mean, how are you going to tell the king who is himself a prophet that his desire to build a temple for the living God is wrong? I mean, it's right on every level, isn't it? So he says to him, do what your heart desires. God's with you. And before the prophet gets out of the courtyard, God speaks to him and says, now go back and tell David no. He's not the man. So he goes back in and he says to David, David, you're not the man. You've got blood on your hands. God has used you for a specific purpose, but your son is the one who's going to build the temple, not you. Now, did that mean that David's desire was wrong? No. What did David then do with his desire? Since God had providentially prevented him from carrying out the desire the way he wanted, what did he do? Well, he drew up the plans for the temple, and he collected the materials for the temple, and he set in order the courses of the Levites and how they were to present themselves. And when Solomon came to power, David handed him the entire package and said, this is it. He spent years preparing everything. Now, it was his burden that the temple be built, but it was not his to build. And yet he used that desire and properly manifested that for God's glory. We don't seek the high place. We let God show us how we can be useful where we are. 7C and 8. What your eyes have seen, do not hastily bring into court. For what will you do in the end when your neighbor puts you to shame? Leadership researches truth and facts before charging others. Leadership researches truth and facts before charging others. It's amazing how sometimes information in the church functions more like the National Enquirer than anything else. We are to find out facts before we start ripping into people, before we deal with things. It's especially true in conflict with one another. Don't assume what you've seen is necessarily the entire truth. Investigate. Question before you start accusing anybody. And it's always good to try and resolve things privately first. And in fact, he's going to deal with that a little bit later. And if I can add a personal word of advice, don't be quick to reveal others' secrets, to expose what others have said or done, because if you were wrong, you're going to bear it for a long, long time. And even if you're right, who's going to trust you in the future? Leaders learn how to guard those things. And they research the truth and the facts before they charge others. I was having dinner with a friend in Texas a few months ago. They told me something supposedly that one
individual had said to another individual who was in a national ministry, and if I were to mention it, everybody here would know. And I said, well, that's interesting, but you know, as of right now, that's hearsay, that's gossip. So tell you what, I'm indifferent. And until, by some means, there's some verification of those facts, they just cannot play a role in the way I think. Just cannot. Aren't you glad that's how God deals with you? When He forgets your sin? And it's not that He isn't mindful of it. How do we know Moses sinned? It's written in the Bible. God doesn't have blindness when He looks at that passage. He wrote it. He put it there for eternity. It's never going to disappear. It isn't like God has some sort of divine amnesia. But what He does do is He doesn't remember it against us. He doesn't take it into account in the way that He deals with us today. If you were to look at the population of Israel when the Levitical priesthood was initially set up, and the priesthood was done in such a fashion that they would rotate their duties. The truth is that if you sinned on Monday and brought your lamb to sacrifice for your sin and confessed to the priest, and then did the same thing the next day and came back and sacrificed your lamb, you would probably be dealing with another priest. The rotation was so great that, in fact, you could probably visit the tabernacle every day throughout the year and never get the same priest twice. The model was, every time you come to Christ and confess your sin, He doesn't say, hey, didn't you bring that to me yesterday? He says, my blood has dealt with that. Well, what sin from yesterday? This is today. What a wonderful way to deal. We have such a good God, and how we can learn to be that way with one another and to be careful. 9 and 10. Argue your case with your neighbor himself, and do not reveal another's secret, lest he who hears you bring shame upon you, and your ill repute have no end. Good leaders seek private resolutions to conflict first. Let me just bring that to the household. Husbands and wives, not in front of the kids. Seek private resolutions. You know, and it's good to do that with your children. When my daughter was very little, one of the things that I did early on, because of the example of my dad, was that when she had done something wrong, I would seldom, if ever, address it in front of her friends. When I had opportunity and took her aside, I would speak with her privately. Because my idea is that I want to help remedy the situation, not humiliate her in front of other people. That's not right. I love the fact that when I confess my sin to Christ, each time I do, He does not send Fred Luke an email saying what I did. Now, Fred would bury that email because he's Fred, but some of you wouldn't. You'd pass it on to others like a chain letter. That isn't how He deals with our sin. He doesn't humiliate us. He deals with it. He seeks private resolution to conflict first. How He comes to us in His Word over and over. Seldom does God expose deep sins in our lives all at once. He's usually been dealing with this privately for a long period of time. And we've refused and hardened our hearts. And then, finally, He brings it out in the open. But He seeks private resolutions first. Verse 11. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. Leaders measure their words carefully. I know that at times, especially in the pulpit, we can speak sometimes with, what do we call that? Evangelistic zeal that goes a little bit over the top. It can happen. We can do that with one another too. Holy exaggerations and things of that nature, but we do need to measure our words carefully, especially in our interactions with one another. Matthew 12:36, I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. You know what that word careless means? It means worthless. A word that has no, cannot possibly do the other person any good. How much of our conversation is worthless?
So it's a good thing to consider. Maybe we need to talk less and listen more. It's the old story about two ears and only one mouth, huh? Or Colossians 4:6, let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Or as my mom would always tell me when I was little, because I had a real razor tongue and my older brother was not quick and I could just cut him to ribbons verbally, and it was just great fun. And my mom would just drag me aside later and she'd say, Reed, she said, make your words sweet, and that way it won't be so bad when you have to eat them. That was good advice. And it paralleled what we're being told here. Verse 12. Like a gold ring or an ornament of gold is a wise reprover to a listening ear. Leaders know the value of wise reproof, both in receiving it and being able to give it as wise reproof. We are not God's enforcers. We are not God's punishers. It's the Holy Spirit who convicts, not us. We're not prosecuting attorneys. It's not our job. And we learn to reprove wisely in a way that calls men to the reality that there is hope and forgiveness. And we do that both in our relationships with one another and even with the lost. We need to tell men that they are lost and dying and on their way to hell and condemned. We absolutely do. We need to tell them in such a way that we also give them the gospel in the process. That there is a Christ who saves. There is forgiveness. Verse 13. Like the cold of snow in the time of harvest is a faithful messenger to those who send him. He refreshes the soul of his masters. Leaders value those who can communicate their messages most faithfully. Leaders value those who can communicate their messages most faithfully. God values those who can communicate his truth faithfully. I don't know if you've ever been caught in a place where there's been miscommunication. A number of years ago, I was listening to the trial of a... There was a man in Buffalo who had shot and killed an abortion doctor. And he was then in Florida. He had done this in Florida, although he lived in Buffalo, and was now on trial for this murder. At the same time, I was in the process of trying to hire a new sales rep for the state of New Jersey. What was odd was that the sales rep and the man who was on trial for murder shared the same name. I'm listening to the trial in my office. And as I'm listening and I'm thinking, whatever our outrage at abortion, and it should be the height of moral outrage and righteous indignation. This guy's approach to ending that was not the right one. And, you know, there's just enough vigilante in me, you know, that I would have been happy if they'd spared us the money of the trial, and, you know, the cop that got him just offed him before we had to try him. But anyway, that's my sin. I have to deal with that. But anyway, they're announcing his conviction. I'm listening intently on the radio in my office when my boss comes through the door and says, well, what do you think of? And he gives this name now. Well, I said, they shouldn't have even tried him. They should have just shot him when they arrested him. They should have saved us all the money. I said, the whole thing's just horrible. He's a murderer, and we shouldn't have to deal with this. And he's standing there in just absolute shock. And then he says to me, the rep killed somebody? Because they had the same name. Now, he's talking the guy in New Jersey. I'm talking the guy in Florida. We both had the name accurately, but we had the wrong person in both cases. Oh, boy. We need people who can communicate faithfully. 2 Timothy 2:2. And what you have heard from me, Paul says, in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. God's truth is a sacred trust committed to our hands, and we need to commit it to those who are faithful and can carry it out. Verse 14, like clouds and wind without rain is a man who boasts of a gift.
He does not give. Leaders put little stock in those who make big promises. Leaders put little stock in those who make big promises. I have got a drawer full of big promises from people that just never came to pass. You don't build your life on those. You're aware. You take things with a grain of salt. Okay. You know, some of those biggest promises are the promises I've made to God about all the things I'm going to fix, all the things I'm going to do, all the things I'm going to, you know, I've promised Him. And usually those promises are attached with a bribe of some sort. You know, I'll never play golf on a Sunday again as long as you do X. Or, you know, I'll never kick the dog again, Lord, if you'll just answer this one prayer. Yeah, those are wrong. And God knows better than to put stock in our promises like that. And we need to be careful that we don't drink them in. Otherwise, we'll walk around in constant disappointment with people who are really good people who in earnest try to promise well, but can't pull it off. Verse 15, with patience a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue will break a bone. Leaders listen to good arguments presented with a right spirit. You do. Maybe even a person who's really opposed to your own point of view. But if they've got a good argument and they come in a right spirit, listen. Listen, it's a wise thing. And it's healthy. You'll find out that often things grow. We had this little discussion with some guys a little while ago about pastors, elders, the leadership in a church, setting the vision for a church. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. But sometimes the vision comes out of the pew. That's what happened in Acts chapter 7. It wasn't the elders that knew that there was a problem with the ministration of the widows. That came out of the pew. The guys out there said, hey, they came to the leadership and said, we've got this big issue and we need it addressed. And they said, well, let's pray about it and we'll come up with a solution. But the idea that this needed to be met, needed to be organized, needed to be handled, came not from the leadership. It came from the other people. And that's good. And they had a well-reasoned argument and they came in the right spirit. This is to meet the need of the day. And it was good. Verse 16, if you have found honey, eat only enough for you, lest you have your full of it, fill of it, and vomit it. That's nice and graphic, isn't it? Leaders know how to govern their appetites. Leaders know how to govern their appetites. Too much of even a good thing can be destructive. We are not to be men of extremes. We learn how to temper. The world looks for workaholics. God doesn't. God doesn't. I've had this argument over the years, and you may think I'm wrong. You may think I'm right. You may applaud me. Send the letters to Fred, not me. It's his church. I get to get away with that. Sometimes, I was sharing with some of you last night that I sat across the table from a young man 8 months ago who is a member of John Piper's church. And he said, my wife and I and our three girls under the age of eight, we have a burden for Afghanistan. I said, really? What are you going to do about that? He said, we're going. I said, Afghanistan's not exactly an evangelism-friendly nation. As a matter of fact, my wife's roommate from college was murdered there 2 years ago in her missionary effort. She was kidnapped and beheaded, we understand. And he said, well, if we aren't prepared to go and die, then who will take them the message? He said, we're perfectly resolved to the fact that our family will probably be killed. I'm looking at a 32-year-old man with a lovely young wife and three little girls. And they're all going to go. Matter of fact, I talked to his dad on Thursday, and his dad said he's there. They're in Afghanistan. They're starting their mission there. Don't know what that's going to look like. Others, missionaries at times, and I think they're doing this right, even in this most dangerous place, is that they're taking their children with them and they're understanding that their first ministry is to their own home, even while they're there. And that's true. Sometimes even guys in ministry, guys who are doing things for the Lord, can forget that our first ministry is our wives and our kids. We need to govern our appetites, not be workaholics the way that it's sinful. I think we should burn ourselves out for the kingdom. But I think we also have to make sure we guard our priorities properly. And as a result, good leaders then try not to impose too much on others. They know that other people are stressed and have limits.
17. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? Leaders do not presume on relationships. They don't presume on relationships. We build relationships, yes, and we need them. But don't presume on them. The church is not Amway. And so you don't invite people over under false pretenses and all that sort of a thing. We're open and honest with what we have to do, and we don't overdo our relationships with one another. That's improper. We've got to be careful. There are certain boundaries that need to be maintained that are healthy and biblical and sound. 18. A man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a war club or a sword or a sharp arrow. Leaders traffic in truth, not tale-bearing. And we need to be careful that we do that with one another and not carry too much bad news about other ministries, other people, the sins of other saints. We're not tale-bearers. That's a war club, a sword, a sharp arrow. Especially if it's false witness and we don't know the truth. 19. Trusting in a treacherous man in a time of trouble is like a bad tooth or a foot that slips. Leaders do not employ the unscrupulous. Leaders do not employ the unscrupulous. I knew a large national ministry once, which will go nameless, and they literally had a guy on staff who was the bulldog, the enforcer. He was the one who fired people. He was the one who made the harsh decisions. He was the one who did all the stuff. He was employed for that very purpose. That's not the church. That's not the church. We don't employ the unscrupulous. We don't find certain men in our congregation who will do the dirty work so that our hands can stay clean. That's not the way that we work in the body of Christ. 20. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day, or like vinegar on soda. Actually, the vinegar on the soda would evaporate it, would cause it to spark up and dissipate. Leaders are not given to pat, dismissive answers to real problems. Boy, some people are really hurt by, at times, our oversimplistic responses to their crises. As we were talking last night with one on the loss of his brother, a pat dismissive answer won't work. Not when a heart's crushed. You sing songs to a heavy heart, it's like one who takes off a garment on a cold day. You know, out of all the things that Job's three comforters did wrong, they did something at the beginning that was really right. They came up and for 3 days they kept their mouths shut and just grieved with him. That was good. That was just good. As I spoke last night about the family in our church who lost their 21-year-old daughter, when I went to the house to pick up her dad and take him to the morgue, we didn't talk in the car. He didn't need me to talk. He needed me to weep with him. Just weep with him. So that's what we did. We just cried together. And after we cried and cried and cried, and then it was time to talk. He didn't need me to say, oh, well, she's in a better place. You know, it's just great, isn't it? Because when we went in that room and they pulled the sheet off her, and she was unrecognizable. And he did faint. And I grabbed him. He just needed us to be there. Don't worry, be happy works for Bobby McFerrin, but not for real people. It just doesn't. 21 and 22. If your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he's thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Leaders have no need to hate and crush their enemies, even when they could. Don't you know I could call 10,000 angels right now, legions of angels? Spare me from this cross. I could do that in a heartbeat, he said. And he didn't. At any moment, he could have done anything he wanted to any of those people that were against him. He could have stopped his enemies in a heartbeat. Never did. No, that isn't what he was here to do. And we need to be careful that we don't either. 23, the north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue, angry looks. Leaders do not engage in sniping at others. There is a form of false leadership, which is the type of leadership that you saw come up in the Third Reich. And that is, you lead by getting everybody to hate somebody else. That's false leadership. You build your entire case on sniping at the other guy. Then you don't really have to lead, because all you've done is just incite hatred. As long as you've got a common hatred, you can kind of channel it. It isn't leadership. If the only way you can make your point is by tearing down the other person, don't make it. Talk ideas. Talk truth. But no need to snipe at the people. 24. It is better to live in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. I thought about just skipping this one. Because I've got enough trouble. But let me just put it in a slightly different, at least extract the principle here. Leaders do not form close alliances with those who are quarrelsome and pugnacious. Leaders do not form alliances, or at least close alliances, with those who are quarrelsome and pugnacious. Now, I have no idea what you may have found yourself in a situation with your wife in the corner of your housetop. I can tell you, especially you younger men, if you aren't married yet, look for someone who is kind. Be kind and look for someone else who is kind. I know sometimes quarrelsome, pugnacious, a little bit of fire there is exciting. Fire burns, man. Look for somebody who's kind and be that kind of person. And we don't surround ourselves with those who are just out. There's a difference between contending for the faith and being contentious about the faith. We need to contend for the faith, but we shouldn't be contentious about the faith. It has to do with our attitude and our heart and mind. 25, like cold water to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. Leaders know that others need encouraged. My brother worked for a company that was slowly going bankrupt. And what they kept doing was just making it harder for everybody. So his entire team went out and had T-shirts printed. And the T-shirts said, "The beatings will continue until attitudes improve." And they wore them in the office that day. And sometimes that's the way it can be. Everybody's going through a rough time. Martin Lloyd-Jones, when he was just beginning his preaching career, went out on a day of preaching with an older pastor. He tells the story in his book, Preachers and Preaching. And as he drove out there, the older preacher was going to preach first, and then he was going to preach, and there were going to be others after them. They used to have days of preaching like this in Wales. And he went out there, and he preached, and then they got back in the car, and they were heading back toward home. And so he said to this elder guy, this mentor at the time, "You know, how do you think things went?" And he said, "Martin, remember that for every 10 people in the pew, 9 of them are hurting." That was good. That was good. It is, Thomas Watson said, William Gurnall, that it is not the least of the care and skill of the preacher so as to preach the things in the Word, not as to leave the burden solely on the shoulders of those who hear, but on the Christ who bears them away. Amen. That is necessary. And don't forget, you know, your wife, your kids, your neighbors, your friends, they all needed courage too. We do not have too many Barnabases in the world. A word of encouragement is so good. 26, like a muddied spring or a polluted fountain is a righteous man who gives way before the wicked. Leaders do not abdicate to wicked challengers. This is a hard one for the church, because there's a lot of wicked challengers out there. And sometimes you want to just give up. But no, leaders do not abdicate to wicked challengers. We stick to what God has given us. Verse 27, it's not good to eat much honey, nor is it glorious to seek one's own glory. Leaders are not self-focused. You ever Google yourself? See what the world's saying about you? It's scary. There's a lot of weird things out there with your name attached to them. But leaders aren't self-focused. We aren't walking around all the time worried about how other people think about us. If you do, then you're the servant of men and not the servant of God. You're here to serve Him, not them. I
remember a little while ago, this is a couple years ago, because my wife's parents live in Texas, and I take my vacation over Christmas, and we go to Texas to be with my wife's parents. Well, there was someone who just didn't like this. They said, no pastor takes Christmas off from his church. I was looking through the manual. I said, where's the Christmas verse? I can't find the Christmas verse. I want it. And she was just adamant. This was just horrible that I was doing this. And then she said the electric sentence. After all, you work for us. So I'm thinking, all right. If I just hit her, I'm going to feel real good, but there's going to be a lawsuit, So it's probably not the best approach. I could trip her when she goes down the aisle. I could tell her she needs to be rebaptized and we could hold her down extra long. There's some things we can do here. I sent her on her way saying, I need to think about that a little bit. I'm not sure how to respond exactly. And I did get back to her later. And I said, maybe some clarification in the way that I understand my role might be helpful for you.